Grade 2 Conference, Lecture 26, Fables, Part 2. So here are some facts, and I put that word in quotations, about Aesop. And you can see that when facts kind of melt into legend, that legends arise because they have meaning, they have significance. You know, even if perhaps this specific human being does not truly fill all of these factual descriptions, we need to have such a being there because he exemplifies something, he embodies something about humanity at that time. So anyway, those scholars don't think he existed at all, some of them anyway. They all agree that he did not exist between the years where he did live, about approximately 620 to 564 BCE. BC, or before Common Era, however you wish to put that. And that he, whether he was born in Africa, Turkey, any of these places, that because of the ceaseless war and territorial expansions and contractions of those times, he was probably captured in battle, and he was made a slave and sold to several Greek families over time. Although he was said to be a homely individual, ugly, as he's called in many ancient documents, possibly humpbacked, definitely in one way or another, or in many ways, very much out of keeping with the Greek standards of beauty and moderation and balance and harmony, yet he managed to survive in these very difficult times where your looks sometimes could be a cause for your being put to death or at least being exiled. He managed to survive. He managed to get freed. And he even found himself at times, because of his exemplary wisdom, he found himself as an advisor to leading political figures and warriors, and perhaps even a king or two along the way. And it was in the course, perhaps, of this last period of his life that his storytelling skills got to be widely known and widely asked for and lauded. And his stories certainly were being transmitted orally, and may in one form or another, as we've seen, the alphabets were certainly developing in that part of the world, probably got written down as well, though very unlikely in his lifetime, because people's memories could certainly accommodate hundreds of short stories being held in the consciousness of a few individuals in a village or even a city who then would continue to transmit these stories. Now, let's look at the time in which he lived. This is the 7th to 6th centuries BCE. This was a time of tremendous change and development in the ancient world. That's one reason for all of the wars that were going on. They weren't just wars about territory or trade routes, though those were very important. They were wars about consciousness as well. There was a very, very great change going on, which would lead then humanity away from the sentient soul consciousness that had been very strong in Egypt to what Steiner would speak of more as the intellectual or mind-soul consciousness that characterized what he termed the Greco-Roman epoch. So we're very much at the dawn of that Greco-Roman epoch, leaving a time when for ancient people what the sentient soul meant was that you could see and hear and tangibly experience the spiritual world. Not everybody, not all the time anymore, but it was the ending of that time in which there were still people who could see the gods, or at least see memory pictures of the gods, who might be able to glimpse very quickly the movement of a naiad near a tree, or another elemental figure, perhaps a sylph or a satyr running by. They could see them for one moment, and then they would sort of disappear into thin air. We can think of how Odysseus again and again encounters Athena or Hermes in the figure of a young woman or a young man, only to have them disappear after they've given him some advice. So this was coming to an end. The gods, the goddesses, the whole world of elemental beings could no longer be seen by everyone. And in fact, just kind of the opposite of our time, the more developed an individual was, the more advanced that individual was, the more responsibility that person had to be bringing people into the next step of cultural development and evolution, the less that individual could see of the spiritual world. So people like Homer were being blind, they were blind to the spiritual world so that they could see into the physical world. Homer's sort of the opposite. He's blind to the physical world and can see into the spiritual world. But there was a leaving of the certainty that the gods existed. And this then, among the Greeks, becomes the age of what are called the pre-Socratic philosophers. The first philosophers, the first individuals who could carry that name, though that is not what they call themselves, they call themselves physicists because they were very interested now suddenly in the physical world. What was this physical world really in its essence? Was it composed of things that we could not see? Or was it composed of things that we were able to see, however small or temporary they might be, however ephemeral they might be in nature? So these pre-Socratics carried many questions. And at this time, one of the most important of them was named Thales, T-H-A-L-E-S. You'll come upon Thales perhaps in grade 5 when you're teaching about ancient Greece. In certain respects, he is the father of geometry. And he had a very great influence on a younger figure named Pythagoras. It's unlikely that the two ever came into physical contact with each other because Thales probably died when Pythagoras was about 5 or 6 years old. Nonetheless, legends hold that these two individuals were connected. Pythagoras, of course, you know, as the greatest of the Greek geometers, with his remarkable epochal discoveries and the beginnings of geometrical proof, although Thales also made some remarkable discoveries himself. So Thales is a contemporary of Aesop. Aesop, the storyteller, lives at the same time in essentially the same part of the world with the same changes in consciousness happening very quickly as one of the very first philosophers, as one of the very first individuals trying to understand the physical world, which is much more interesting than the shadowy, nebulous, even invisible world of spirit and soul. So here's one of Aesop's contemporaries, and here again, Ancient historians often link the two and said that they were good friends. And indeed, I will tell you a fable, which is often considered to be a fragment of the life of Thales. If we go further east, as Pythagoras was to do just a few years after the death of Aesop, we go further east, we will find in Babylon, which was now the largest city in the world, the most populous and the most powerful, a city of many great conquerors, but also one in which mathematics and trade and other means of mastering the physical world were being practiced very often. We find there among the Babylonians living in exile one of the great Hebrew prophets, Ezekiel. And these prophets were very important figures because they too were no longer able, in the way that Abraham and Moses could, they could not look upon the face of God. They often did not hear the voice of God, or if they did, they could not always understand what God was trying to tell them. The prophets are kind of agonizing, tragic figures who know that the Israelites have caused their own destruction and doom, and yet are trying to find the right path without having divine guidance before them at all times. So Ezekiel was a figure perhaps encountered by Pythagoras in Babylonia. Another figure who was there was one of the Magi. It is said the last of the Zoroastras, the last of the Zarathustras, a being whom Steiner has spoken of again and again as one of the most important initiates of ancient times, whose work continues to cast its ripples into our age as well. You'll be talking about him in grade 5, by the way. So the last of the Zoroastras was there, the last of the Zarathustras, because many had carried this name from even more ancient times, and he was the one who said, "I am appearing as Zarathustra on the earth for the last time. The next time, you will have to look for my star. You Magi, will see a star that shines. Follow that star, and I will be there." So here we have one of the antecedents of the great legends of the coming of the Jesus child. So he too is living on earth at the same time as Aesop. And if we go still further east, we encounter, and here again historians dispute this chronology quite a bit, but it's very possible that Siddhartha, later to be the Buddha, was on the earth at this time, and very likely that further east still in China, Confucius and Lao Tzu, the founders of the great ethical paths of inner development, were also teaching at this time and changing the face of cultural and social life in China. What do all of these figures have in common? Lao Tzu, Confucius, the Buddha, Ezekiel, Zarathustra, the pre-Socratic philosophers, Pythagoras, they are all saying, do not look for God. You're not going to find him. He's not going to make himself manifest to you. Buddha would say, don't even worry about God. Rather, become divine yourself and do it on the earth. You will be able now in your own life, follow my teachings or follow this teaching or that teaching, in your own life through being ethical, through being compassionate, through being connected with your fellow human being in a new way, you will be able to overcome the foibles, the lower qualities of what Steiner would speak of as the astral body, and you will be able to raise it up to a level in which you yourself can be a divine-like figure to your fellow human beings. And I would say that this basic message, which is really the turning of an age, the turning point of time in the ancient world, from a theocratic society in which everything was ruled by the gods, to a human-centered society, the demos, in which one carries the divine within, democracy. Not that this was to occur all over the world by any means, but at least the seed of this is being planted. And Aesop's stories are also part of this transition, this leaving the godly world and instead looking into nature and trying to see nature as a great parable, as a set of allegories about the new steps that the human being must take. And in this respect, as the second grader leaves the world of unity and still trailing clouds of glory, as Wordsworth said, from pre-birth and from early years of life, and now in second grade, that child finds him or herself in a very different world in which one is not sustained in the same way by the past. One is standing at a crossing point. Third grade will bring that crossing point even more strongly to the fore. These fables are very important stories which really give the child a kind of insight, a kind of harbinger of his or her own future. So if we see these in the historical context out of which they arose, whether there was one Aesop or hundreds of Aesops, whether these stories actually go back much further, whether they're the stories that Africans knew from a time when the animals could speak to them, whether they come perhaps to us even from Atlantis or further back than that, the important thing is that they come to human consciousness in a new way with greater urgency and importance in the 7th and 6th centuries BC when humanity is going through a very great transition, and they speak to the second grader who we could say on an individual level, on a very sleepy level, dreamy level, is going through a similar transition and is about to bid farewell to all of early childhood and start to take a step towards the middle school years. We'll hear more about these fables in our next lecture.